I'm Carol Coletta, and this is Smart City. Our topic today is urban innovation, but on two very different subjects. In his forthcoming book, Engaging Art, The Next Great Transformation of America's Cultural Life, Stephen Tepper calls on urban and arts leaders to make sweeping changes in the way they build cultural vitality for our cities. He advocates a shift from art consumption to art making, a move he believes can dramatically change cities. And we'll talk to Mike Rimpel, an innovator in our court system, particularly when it comes to dealing with drugs and domestic violence. We'll talk about a range of urban innovations today on Smart City, right after the news. You're listening to Smart City. I'm Carol Coletta. Stephen Tepper is Associate Director of the Curb Center for Art, Enterprise, and Public Policy, an assistant professor in the Department of Sociology at Vanderbilt University. Previously, Stephen served as the Deputy Director of the Princeton University Center for Arts and Cultural Policy Studies. With his colleague Bill Ivey, Stephen has edited a new book, Engaging Art, The Next Great Transformation of America's Cultural Life. Stephen, what's happening to cultural participation in the U.S.?
What's happening? Well, we're arguing in this new book of ours that we may be experiencing a renaissance in participation. In many quarters of the arts world, we hear sort of sad songs of decline, people concerned about the graying of their audiences, the decline in subscribers, season subscribers. But if you look at other indicators, I think we see audiences becoming more engaged, more interactive, more participatory. It's really a creative renaissance. I think our arts organizations and our arts leadership needs to connect with this new vitality that's emerging. And we need to make sure that all Americans will have the chance to engage art and culture in a more dynamic, more active, more interactive way.
What are those indicators that you see that give you hope?
Well, there's a number of them. Certainly, new technology has changed the landscape, but it's not just new technology. But let me start there. The one thing we've seen is an explosion of choice and people taking advantage of that. So we've heard the notion of the long tail, which describes all the cultural goods that kind of lie outside the mainstream that people now have access to, where before when shelf space was limited in record stores or Walmart or in theater chains, you could only get the stuff that was selling the best. But now people can wander way off into the off the beaten path to find music, to find video, to find artworks, to find books from all over the world. And to kind of match their unique and special interests with unique and special culture that's out there and other fans of that culture so they can find each other online. So we have this explosion of choice. We have what we're calling the curatorial me, which is, you know, new devices allow us to time shift, to capture digital video and audio and replay it at our own time and convenience in combination with other audio and video, so that instead of having other people curate our lives, telling us exactly how to see this exhibit, in what order, or when to watch these shows, or what order to listen to this music, we can kind of decide that ourselves. So I think that also has energized consumers. We also have, I think, just a growth in sort of what I'd call a creative ethos, and this has been documented by others. You know Richard Florida's work well on the rise of the creative class, but there's independent evidence that, at least for young people, being accomplished in an artistic form is increasingly important to them. This is evidence that's coming from the freshman survey that's done every year of incoming freshmen around the country, that this is increasingly one of their life's aspirations. We see the number of majors in artistic disciplines going up, the number of design majors is escalating. So we see a rising generation that seems to be extremely invested in their own creative lives And of course, we're seeing that spilling out into all kinds of ways online, in MySpace and Facebook, where young people are literally creatively documenting their lives in all kinds of ways. So those are a few of the transformations. I think we also are witnessing sort of a do-it-yourself movement, and that's both sort of among professionals but also among amateurs. So we're seeing the rise of independent record labels and indie bands that just sort of, instead of depending on someone else to get their word out or market, they just do it themselves. We see, you know, the cost of recording in a home studio has plummeted, and more people are making music and sharing that music online. 80% of Americans say they want to write a book, and now they have the capacity to distribute that book and to get it printed cheaply. So we see a do-it-yourself culture, a curatorial me, more interaction, and more sort of engagement in the creative process and not just as sort of passive audiences.
It's interesting when you talk about the statistic, 80% of us want to write a book, which I find quite remarkable. And, of course, if you look at YouTube and what's there, you look at what is searched on Google, and I have to, at popular television programs like, and you cited in your book, American Idol, those don't give me a lot of hope about the, certainly choice, yes, choice, but quality, think twice. So how do you reconcile this broader choice with quality? Does quality still matter?
I think there always will be a space for quality, but on the whole, in the last 40 or 50 years, cultural policy has made excellence and quality its primary mission and objective, and I think has sacrificed participatory arts. I just give an example. I don't think one precludes the other. So if we use sports as an analogy, we can think about sports as a pyramid, with professional athletes sitting at the top of that pyramid. There aren't that many who make it into the professional realm. And below that is kind of a base of participatory practice, people who are amateur athletes who play baseball or soccer or tennis or golf, who run and take those sports seriously. And then below that is an even wider base of what you would call sort of people who are literate about sports and who engage in conversation about it and keep up with it and watch it on a regular basis. And that sports ecology is sort of supported in a number of ways, not just at the top. There's a lot of policies in this country have been focused at the middle level, at participatory sports, at amateur sports, whether it's the NCAAs or rec leagues or athletics in schools. And we know that those two lower bases support the excellence at the top, so that the whole sports ecology is healthier. It's not as if there's a competition between the quality athletes and the amateur athletes. And I think the same thing is true in the arts. That is, if we could invest more of our resources in creating a large number of participatory creative individuals, amateur artists, and an even larger number of sort of committed arts connoisseurs, then all of that would feed into a greater interest, a greater passion for high-quality, excellent professional art.
I want to stick with this analogy, which I thought was very intriguing, this idea of the sports pyramid. And I want to understand if you think we had more participation in the arts, if we were doing more training, because in effect that's what the sports business, my gosh, has become. Do you think if we supported that sort of participation at a much younger age, both through schools and through, for instance, parks and recreation, do you think then that we would have more attendance?
Absolutely.
Okay, so you think that does lead to attendance?
I think we know it leads to attendance. If you look at surveys of arts participation, which is basically attendance, there are questions in there about practice, mm-hmm. and also about arts learning as mm-hmm. As young adults or as children, and those things are highly predictive of adult participation. And certainly, the schools will remain a central place to try to engage partners for encouraging a participatory creative culture. But, you know, the schools are burdened with a lot of responsibilities, and I think we need to be more creative about other kinds of partners and other kinds of collaborations. I mean, as an example, there's been an explosion of DVDs, instructional DVDs about how to play musical instruments, guitar. And some of this actually happens on YouTube. You can pull up a video of someone showing you a lick of a particular song on guitar. And these DVDs are right now being circulated. You know, they're proprietary. They're for profit. They're making money. But there's no reason why foundations and nonprofits couldn't partner with them to try to provide reduced prices, subsidized, free, for you know, and loaning libraries. So I think there's other kinds of partners that we can look to. The Association of Music Manufacturers has a whole program called Weekend Warriors, which I think describes this notion of professional amateurs just wonderfully. These people who don't play musical instruments for a full-time job, they don't make their money at it, but they're committed amateurs, and they get together in the evenings and on the weekends with other committed amateurs, and they play together. And this association provides resources to facilitate those amateur bands. And so I think other than the schools, schools are clearly central. There are other partners we need to look to help encourage and support participatory culture.
You seem to be comfortable with a no growth or slow growth attendance at what you call benchmark art forms, opera, symphony, theaters, dance, art museums. Is that because you don't think it can be changed, or that we're better off without it, or we simply have to invest in participation and teaching that will then lead ultimately to more attendance?
Right. So we're a bit behind the eight ball because we made a critical decision in the 1960s. The Ford Foundation, the Rockefeller Foundation, the National Endowment for the Arts all decided that the goal was really to build the nonprofit arts community in America and make sure the arts were available, the benchmark arts were available to Americans in every city. And that was extraordinarily successful. And the number of nonprofit arts organizations grew by more than 10 times in those three decades. And I think there's signs that we've probably overgrown. Overgrown the market. And my guess is if the decision we had made back then was a combination of growing nonprofits but also maybe providing people with creativity vouchers to go learn how to do something, mm-hmm. You'd have a healthier audience now. But I also think we need to the challenge for us is that we in the arts field are invested in certain kinds of cultural forms that we mm-hmm. care deeply about, and we want to see them prosper. And I will set myself in that group of advocates who care about those organizations. But if we compare the arts with, let's say, a conversation that was happening a decade ago when Robert Putnam was first publishing his ideas about bowling alone and the decline of civic America, he first came out with his sort of statistics about how membership in the PTA and the Rotary Club and all kinds of voluntary associations was plummeting. And he had very rigorous data, very strong trend lines. And he published his work, and scholars from all over the place said, "Hey, you're measuring the wrong things. You know, PTA memberships are going down, but soccer, you know, the soccer leagues are going up." I think we're doing the same thing in the arts to some extent. That we want to keep measuring attendance to the nonprofits, and we care about that. But you know, if there are new ways in which, especially young people, are engaging in the arts in qualitatively similar ways. So what I mean by that is, I'm kind of content neutral about the arts. I don't care if it's classical music or slam poetry or graffiti, for that matter. What I care about is that the participants bring with them the same critical judgment, notion of expertise, connoisseurship, and that's what we should be promoting, is that all of our citizens can engage thoughtfully and deeply and reflectively in some creative pursuit And be less focused on having to define what those pursuits need to be, that is opera, theater, dance, classical music.
You're listening to Smart City. Our guest is Stephen Tepper. He is co-editor with Bill Ivey of the new book, Engaging Art, The Next Great Transformation of America's Cultural Life. And Stephen, you expect it to be in bookstores when?
I think middle of October.
Okay, so soon. I'm really looking forward to. I've read pieces of it, of course, but not the whole thing, and I'm eager to read it. You talk about. I buy your point overall. You're content neutral. I understand why. Taste change, needs change, but I think one of the roles that art has always played is helping us understand what it means to be human. What are the great conflicts? What are the great stories? What are the things that are timeless? Presenting something beautiful or challenging. I mean, they're great art certainly plays a role in making us more human and helping us understand what being human means. And I'm wondering how you get critical judgment and thoughtful and deep engagement in art participation without having those great works of art, and I mean that in every form, available, widely available to people who may also be moved to make art?
Well, I think we need to ask ourselves challenging questions about, well, how much do we need? What does it mean to be widely available?
Mm-hmm.
Do you need 400 symphonies in America? Do you need 25? How often does that interaction have to be live? I mean, these are good questions and ones that we haven't grappled with in the arts community. We've
accepted that quantity is valuable and that we need it. Now that we have 400 symphonies, we need 400 symphonies.
Right. And so I think we need symphonies, and I think we need that classical art form to be available, and I think we need to build more opportunities for audiences to find that music on their own terms. I mean, I don't see, you know, we know that our orchestras rarely play new music by new composers. I mean, that's it's hard for any art form to survive if it doesn't embrace something about contemporary life. And you could imagine, I mean, there's lots of ways a symphony, a community symphony, a city symphony could mix things up a little bit, and some are already doing that. I mean, there's some wonderful examples of kind of orchestras working with other genres, bringing in a fiddler or creating a hip-hop orchestra. But, you know, they could also take 10 minutes in the middle of their concert and let a young 17-year-old composer play the piece of a young 17-year-old composer in their community. You know, a piece that may be extremely different from the classical works, but nonetheless draws on, you know, orchestral scoring and orchestral standards. Why not do that? I mean, what would be wrong with trying to make the art form more contemporary and speak more to the interests of new generations and the interests of their community more broadly? So I think these art forms need to be preserved. I don't know how many. I think we need to ask that hard question. And I think even those that we feel are perfect the way they are, they still need to figure out ways to reach their audiences and interact in new ways. I mean, we have to be realistic about changing habits. I mean, if people are not sitting for 2 hours to participate in a cultural event, is there a way we can rethink classical music or opera so that people can engage it in smaller segments? Maybe there's not. Maybe it destroys the art form, and I'm willing to engage that conversation. But yeah. I think we have to ask the question.
Well, I think that's a fascinating conversation. It goes back, for me, at least a bit, to your sports analogy. I keep thinking, okay, could you add winning and losing, betting and beer drinking, and conversations with friends to art? And then, in fact, you might have something that's far more popular. Would you have something that's better? I don't think so.
Well, you're describing Shakespeare theater in the 19th century. and one of the chapters in the book sort of talks about that. I mean, people were loud during the theater. They had vociferous disagreements about the difference between an English actor and an American actor. In fact, the Astor Street riots were where dozens of people died.
And please, people, you're not advocating that, are
people
you?
People were invested in the art form, and and they didn't sit quietly on their hands. They had opinions, and they felt like they could legitimately express them. I mean, another problem I think we have in the arts is the over-professionalization of art. And what I mean by that is the ethos of professional artists to present the final piece, you know, with no warts, no rough edges. This is the art. We do not allow you backstage to see the process. And I think Americans, I think people in every culture want to see the creative process. And I think artists, professional artists, have alienated their publics by not allowing them in.
Mm-hmm.
And that's another way where you don't have to change the art form. But, you know, the audience should know how hard it is to perform a new piece of orchestral music. And they should see, you know, the first violin struggling, having to do it over and over again. There has to be a way to allow our artists to be more vulnerable, and to open up the creative process and invite people in. And that's what you see in some of the reality TV shows that we may think are, you know, lowering our standards but are inviting the audience in, whether it's because you're watching a competition, you see people fail, or Project Runway, you see designers working up an idea from scratch and sometimes failing. So I think television in some ways and reality TV and popular culture gets it better than high culture does.
Well, I certainly I think you make many good points. Let me ask you this. If your goal were to make a more vibrant, more appealing city, how would you spend money on the arts?
Well, I would certainly invest in sort of the equivalent of public media centers where people could come and make art, make media, make films, edit their own films, have studios that were available for people to edit their music. And some cities do have these. So I would encourage more of those kinds of things. I would encourage I would have a special grant program for our nonprofit arts organizations to, you know, do exactly some of the things I was saying, to figure out ways to engage their audiences in the creative process, to the LA Music Center, for example, in Los Angeles, it's attached to their new beautiful performing arts center, Disney Hall, is they have a program where they invite the community basically to use their space in and around the building to perform together. So they 1,000 flutists will show up and play together. Or there'll be dancing, dance lessons for the whole community. And so it's not as if the LA Music Center has abandoned its role in presenting great art, but it has now shifted to not only presenting great art to the people, but also enabling the creative capacity of citizens.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And I think that's the shift. You know, if organizations can see themselves not only as bringing great art to the people, which has been the sort of umbrella motto for 40 years, but sort of begin to shift and see their role equally, if not more, sort of unleashing the creative capacities of people. I think, and that's going to be challenging. I mean, I think I would, if I was in a city, I'd organize a small summit around that exact conversation, get our arts leaders thinking about how they can do that. And I think it's appropriate for a mayor to say, you know, you organizations are assets to the city, and we need you to think about how you use your assets to unleash the creative capacity of our citizens, because that's the kind of city we want to have. We want to have a city where our citizens feel like their expressive lives are rich, where they have the capacity to create, to be part of creative ventures together, to collaborate. And I think our existing nonprofits have to figure out a way to allow cities to become those kinds of places.
Let me ask you this, though, Stephen. I think you've argued for engaging more people in the conversation than just our arts nonprofits.
That's correct. Yeah, that's right. So that meeting might involve local theater chains. It might involve, you know, what's left of the record stores. It might involve your bars and club venues. It might involve your booksellers. It might involve a whole range of other entities in the community. I think that's right. That's a good point.
Let me ask the question just a little bit differently. If your goal were to encourage a vibrant art scene in your city, how would you spend your money?
I would certainly invest in arts education and be more open-minded about where that could take place, mm-hmm. including in our churches and synagogues mm-hmm. and mosques. So I would invest in, obviously, in arts education, but invest in arts education in multiple venues, not just in the expected places. I would invest in spaces that are open for public performance and amateur musicians. So, you know, a lot of cities make it very difficult for street musicians. I think, I think obviously public art, having art happening throughout the city by both professionals and amateurs is important. I think investing in festivals. And I think also being eclectic in supporting and sponsoring and showcasing people who are doing non-traditional art.
After a short break, we'll talk with Mike Rempel about innovations in how our courts deal with drugs and domestic violence. Smart City is made possible by the generous support of Memphis Urban Innovators, a collaboration of Memphis business leaders, including the Memphis Tourism Foundation, who are focused on bringing smart people, smart ideas, and smart solutions to Memphis in the new economy. You're listening to Smart City. You're listening to Smart City. I'm Carol Coletta. The latest news in the world of urban planning, design, and development comes to us from Planetta's and assistant editor, Nate Berg.
In what may be one of the most accurate and effective examples of its kind, a dynamic real-time mapping project recently tracked the flow of traffic and pedestrians in the city of Rome and displayed it on a publicly accessible website. The project was initiated during Rome's recent all-night street festival, Notte Bianca, in association with the Massachusetts Institute of Technology's Sensible City Laboratory, and was able to map the flow of mobility in the city by locating active cell phone signals and global positioning system devices on buses and taxis. Discovery News reports that the so-called Wiki City Rome blocked any personally identifying information from the signals, allaying fears of Big Brother watching over. And though this mobility map was only a temporary experiment, the system's designers say it could be one of the most accurate and most easily accessible ways to map mobility in a city, from detecting traffic congestion miles ahead on the freeway to seeing how far away the next bus is from the stop. Meanwhile, an interesting trend has been observed that offers some clues as to why people choose to live where they live. In an article from the Journal of Political Economy, researchers using census data have found that households tend to self-segregate based on education levels and race, and that many are willing to pay a little more to live near people that are just like themselves. It was found that college-educated households were willing to pay $58 more per month than non-college-educated households to live in a neighborhood with slightly more college-educated people. And along the same vein, blacks were willing to pay more per month than whites to live in a neighborhood with more black residents. These trends may seem unsurprising, but the article says that they are nonetheless important as they elevate the correlations observed beyond mere stereotypes. And finally, Kansas City, Missouri has passed a law prohibiting any new billboards from being built and displayed on city streets and sets strict standards for highway roadside advertising within the city. The controversial law follows an example set by Sao Paulo, Brazil, which this year passed a ban on all outdoor advertising, known as the Clean City Law. Many in Kansas City have heralded the new law as a major progressive step for the Midwestern city. But many local business people are outraged, arguing that the ban will do nothing more than harm small business. For Planetizen, I'm Nate Berg.
Nate Berg is assistant editor for PlanEdison.com.
Recently, the Kennedy School of Government and the Ash Institute, in partnership with the National Institute of Justice, looked at the state of what are called drug courts. These courts over the last 20 years have begun to model new approaches to the kind of overwhelming number of drug cases in any urban area presents. And most of us who were former prosecutors saw many of those cases result in inappropriate or inadequate sentences. Sometimes dealers received too small a sentence. Sometimes users didn't receive any help. The cases were often mixed up with other cases in courts that had very little specialty training. And when we brought together experts for this online conversation, which is archived at the Kennedy School of Government, to look at 1,500-plus drug courts that have originated since 2005 and what the results were, very interesting findings were found in terms of assessment and judicial monitoring and graduated sanctions and rewards and treatment services. These results are quite promising. As substantial a problem as drug usage is today, there's a lot to be said for the empirical evidence that suggests drug courts can, in fact, make a difference.
Mike Rimpel is research director for the Center for Court Innovation. He was recently the principal investigator of a statewide evaluation of New York's adult drug courts, and he's currently working on a national study of specialized domestic violence courts and a multi-site evaluation testing the impact of adult drug courts across the country. He is co-editor of Documenting Results, Research on Problem-Solving Justice. Mike, we usually focus our conversations on Smart City about the things going right in cities, but drugs and the crimes that surround them are problems that plague all communities, cities, suburbs, and now rural communities, especially with the increase in meth. What are the latest trends in drug use prosecutions?
Drug use prosecution, of course, you probably know, in the 1980s, there was an emphasis on what we call the war on drugs, where the emphasis was primarily in prosecutions, stiffer sentences. What happened as a result of that is that the prison population, the jail population, skyrocketed. Costs to jurisdictions all over the country skyrocketed. And beginning in the 1990s, there started to be a look at more rehabilitative alternatives, where instead of sending the drug-using population to jail or prison, there became an emphasis on using treatment both as a way to not send defendants to jail or prison and also as a way to address the underlying problem through a prevention approach.
Has treatment been effective?
Well, you have to answer that in two ways. First of all, you have to look at treatment in general, if it's been effective. And the results are quite stunning. Most times when I present on this, about 10 to perhaps in the best programs, a third of those who go to treatment end up graduating from it. So treatment in general has mixed results. What's quite encouraging is that it's been found that when individuals are under some sort of legal coercion, when they do end up in the criminal justice system and they're mandated to treatment, that the results are far more positive, so that 10 to 30% graduation rate becomes more like 50+% for example, in the drug courts or some of the other court-based treatment programs. And the reason for that improvement has to do directly with the legal incentives involved in being mandated to treatment, namely facing some kind of legal benefit, a case dismissal, or a charge reduction in the event of graduating from the program, or facing jail or prison time in the event of failing.
That's amazing. There wasn't enough room in jails when we began to prosecute drug crimes. Is there plenty of room in treatment?
It depends. The general pattern across many states is that there is room in outpatient facilities, but for those who need residential facilities, who need to stay overnight in treatment for 30-day, 6-month, 1-year periods of time, the treatment capacity tends to be a little bit lower. Waiting times might be only 10 days in some places, but could be 30, 60, 90 days in other places. California is engaged in a major experiment with expanding treatment and has relied primarily on outpatient treatment for this reason, that the residential slots are just a little bit less plentiful.
Are we connecting the budgets of the money we spend on arresting drug users, prosecuting drug users, and then treating drug users? Do we think about those budgets as one budget intended to do a job?
Yes, that's an interesting question. The answer, although I'm by no means a budget expert, the answer, as I've seen it, is by and large no. Actually, what you've just mentioned, the prosecution, for instance, and the courts have their own budgets. For the most part, the drug treatment or the drug court programs are funded by courts, which have different funding than, for example, prosecutors or, for example, correctional systems. Now, the drug courts, of course, save money for prosecutors and the correctional systems because there's less reoffending, and so these other systems may save money in the long run. But in terms of the initial investment for these kinds of programs, the courts have by and large borne the burden, but there's not necessarily this connection that you mentioned.
You mentioned efficiency. What was the original reason for setting up drug courts?
All right. The first drug court, interestingly enough, was founded by Janet Reno, our former United States Attorney General, when she was the Attorney General in Miami-Dade County in Florida. Now, the rationale for that first drug court was not to rehabilitate the offenders so much as to cope with the massive influx of drug cases. The method of coping with this massive influx was to take all of the offenders charged with drug-related offenses and put them before a single judge, put them in a single courtroom, and deal with them in a streamlined, more efficient way, try to get quick dispositions, try to get judges, prosecutors, defense attorneys ready to come into this courtroom knowing they were dealing with drug cases and having a standard way of resolving the cases. Over time, the goals of what I'm referring to as drug courts became less about efficiency and more about rehabilitation when it was realized that by using treatment along the way and as part of the package of what was done in, again, what were initially these efficiency-oriented systems, that you actually were getting reductions in reoffending and that you could have a different type of benefit by putting drug cases before a single judge in a single courtroom, have that judge gain expertise in handling these kinds of cases and supervise them more aggressively than a standard courtroom. And if you like, we can talk about what I mean by supervise more aggressively. As I mentioned, the first drug court began in 1989. Now, before then, there was by no means an absence of treatment in the criminal justice system. Many, many offenders were mandated to treatment before 1989. The differences are really twofold in terms of what happened in the drug courts. First of all, the use of quote-unquote multiple chances. Typically, court-mandated treatment before 1989 involved a judge sending someone to treatment and then waiting either to hear that the individual graduated treatment or failed, and then in the event that they dropped out of treatment, the judge would then impose a jail or prison sentence. The drug court, on the other hand, tended to give multiple chances. In other words, someone might skip out of a treatment program. The judge would sanction that individual perhaps with a day or two in jail and then send them right back to treatment. This is extremely important for improving outcomes because it's been just shown that most individuals with an addiction problem are going to relapse and they're going to skip out of treatment or they're going to miss appointments. Early on, if you can retain them, if you can work with them with, for instance, interim penalties short of actually imposing incarcerative sentences, then you have a chance of reducing the noncompliance and getting them on the right track. Now, multiple chances, that's the first component that drug courts brought to the table. The second component is what you might refer to as the proactive court, or the proactive judge, defined by a series of strategies, including appearing regularly before the judge, perhaps every week, every 2 weeks, every 3 weeks, instead of only at the end of treatment, so that the judge can receive progress updates, actually engage in a conversational interaction with the person in the drug court, encourage them if they're doing well, or impose interim penalties if there are reports of noncompliance. Both interviews with drug court participants, as well as some hard data, shows that this reporting back to court often is motivational. It's contributed to some of the effectiveness in this program. Some other strategies have to do with the use of supervision officers or case managers and extensive contacts with these case managers who work primarily for the court, not for the treatment agency, to shepherd participants through treatment, potentially switching them from one treatment program to another if they need another program, greater drug testing, a series of judicial strategies rooted not in the treatment programs themselves, but actually rooted in the court, has really changed the way courts have used treatment from the pre-1989 model to, I guess, the drug court model or the post-1990 model.
What would be an example, Mike, of an interim penalty?
All right. There could be a number of examples. For, let's say, missing a single appointment in outpatient treatment, you might have a penalty such as writing an essay on the importance of recovery, the importance of attending treatment. Perhaps what is called a quote-unquote jury box sanction, where the individual might be required to sit in court all day long, or perhaps in court for 2 days. In some programs, this sanction might they might sit in court all day long. At the very end of the court session, as they see people come in, get sentenced to jail, or get rewarded for completing treatment, it's quite interesting to observe these courts. You might then, at the end of the session, have the judge talk to the person who had the jury box sanction about what they learned from sitting in court all day long or sitting in court for 2 days. So that would be an example of a penalty. Community service is another. And then for more serious infractions, they might have to go to jail for 1 day, 2 days, 3 days, 7 days, but then after this short jail stay, be readmitted to the program. So these are examples of interim penalties.
There's long been a discussion of legalizing certain drugs. I'm curious, with your experience studying drug courts, what's your opinion on that?
Well, first of all, let's be clear. My role is as a researcher and, I guess, to tell the facts about these programs. Now, if you want me to go beyond that and offer an opinion, based on the evidence, I think that would be a huge mistake. The reasons being what I mentioned earlier, that if you have legalization, right, the theory is that is that you're not criminalizing drug use, that it becomes less underground. But the reality is that in those circumstances, you're going to have worse success rates in treatment, because it's been shown that the success rates in treatment are relatively low without the pressure of a court mandate. So there is actually a positive role for the criminal justice system in catching those who are engaged in crime motivated by drug use and in addressing the addiction problem. So from an effectiveness standpoint, my view would be a huge mistake. Now, from a political or a philosophical standpoint, let's say I have no opinion.
And where are the best examples of drug courts?
Where? Well, there are, just to give you an idea, there are over 1,600 in the country. Of that number, 900 are in the criminal context. There are also what we call family drug courts that deal with abuse and neglect cases, and juvenile drug courts. The best and the worst drug courts are all over. But some of the practices that create the best drug courts are using legal incentives, having a good positive incentive for getting through the drug court, such as having the case dismissed, and a good negative incentive, such as facing jail or prison time, making these benefits and consequences clear to participants, using behavior modification techniques effectively in terms of the use of sanctions, where you use these interim penalties, you use some interim penalty every single time there's some infraction, and you build up those penalties gradually. So you start with a small penalty the first time, more serious penalties the next time. Having frequent and meaningful interactions with the judge has been shown to be a good practice in drug court programs. Targeting the more serious offenders, actually targeting the felony offenders as opposed to the misdemeanor offenders, is actually associated with a more effective program. And again, that has to do with the reality that your more serious offenders give you a better bang for the buck because they're facing more jail or prison time. They have a greater incentive to avoid that and succeed in drug court. So just the difference between what would happen without the drug court and what does happen in it are greater for the more serious offenders. So those are all, I guess, practices or strategies that in the drug courts that do use them make them more effective. In the study we did in New York, we found our best results in the Queens drug court. Queens is a borough of New York City, and in terms of the strategies I just mentioned, the Queens program engages in each and every one, and so that program cut its reoffending rate by more than half, whereas other drug courts have had smaller effects.
What you describe as a good drug court sounds like a good parent.
Some people call drug court parenting. Some people say that judges in drug court are acting like as social workers. What is clear is that drug courts represent, I guess one could call, an interdisciplinary approach within the legal system. In other words, drug courts exist within the legal system, but they're carried out by mixing the practices, the language, the techniques of law, of social work, of research into a package. So there is this interdisciplinary component, whether we want to call it parenting or social work, I'm not sure.
I want to shift gears and ask you about domestic violence and what you've learned about what works in taking domestic violence to court.
Well, now we're going to switch to a more difficult story to tell. As successful as the drug courts have been, domestic violence is such a serious problem in our society, and yet the research literature has found far fewer practices that have been effective in addressing domestic violence. Within a court context, for instance, batter treatment, most of the research that's been done has found that actually it doesn't work, just as, by conversely, most of the research on substance abuse treatment finds that it does work as long as you can retain people in it. A few things that have been found to maybe work based on some of the literature with domestic violence offenders have to actually do more with deterrence than with rehabilitation. For instance, intensive probation has some positive results behind it. Using the judge in some similar ways as in drug courts, having frequent judicial status hearings, appearing people before the judge, there are some suggestive studies that suggest that that may be effective with domestic violence offenders as well. But the overall story is a little bit more troubling when you look at the domestic violence population in terms of the search for something that works with that population. The batter treatment programs don't appear to work as well, and I think our hopes there are pinned, quite frankly, more on deterrence-based approaches.
Is domestic violence generally being treated in separate courts?
Well, generally, in terms of in your average courtroom, no, although there is a growing movement just as there is to establish specialized drug courts to handle drug cases in specialized courts. There's a growing movement to do the same with domestic violence. There are, however, many important differences in the approach. Probably the summary of the differences is that while the drug court, as it evolved, eventually came to be about rehabilitation, as it evolved, the domestic violence court came to be about giving the judge and the staff in that court expertise in handling domestic violence, promoting the safety of victims, linking them with services, and holding the offender accountable. Accountability tends to be stressed in the domestic violence court a bit more than rehabilitation for the reason I mentioned earlier, that there is no known proven effective rehabilitative treatment for domestic violence at this point in time.
Are there things you've learned in studying both drug courts and domestic violence courts that you think has application to the entire court system?
Well, philosophically, what's really interesting about these programs is the direction they represent. I think that what we've learned is that while we hear a lot of discussion in the papers and in political debate about activist judges, what we've learned is that in the context we've been talking about in this conversation, the proactive court can make a positive difference, that the judicial branch of government actually can play a role in picking up from the failings of other branches of government in affecting social problems. I think that's the overall lesson that we've learned, that there can be a proactive court that is not just dedicated to correctly adjudicating cases, correctly upholding due process, but also to addressing some of the underlying problems of the individuals who are coming to court, that the judicial branch of government can have some positive effects in that area where maybe other institutions in our society have failed vulnerable populations.
Mike, thanks for being our guest on Smart City.
Thanks, it's a pleasure.
Mike Rimpel is Research Director for the Center for Court Innovation. You're listening to Smart City. I'm Carol Coletta. This week, City View's commentator Walker Smith takes a fresh look at our less-than-perfect cities.
I was out walking in my neighborhood one morning, carefully making my way along an old, cracked, and broken sidewalk, when it hit me that a sidewalk like that is one of the things I like most in a neighborhood. Now, I know that this sounds odd, and at first I wasn't quite sure why I'd had that sudden stab of partiality for crumbling pieces of city sidewalks. But the more I thought it over, the more I came to realize that it wasn't so much the sidewalks per se as all of the other things I've come to associate with cracked and broken sidewalks. Like the tall, shady trees that line the streets of old neighborhoods and push their roots up through the sidewalks, breaking them into pieces. Tall, mature trees mean established neighborhoods, places that have endured, sometimes for the better, sometimes for the worse, but either way with a history and a reckoning with time and tradition. Not that I don't like to be in vogue. It's just that I like to ground myself in places with roots. Roots of every sort, and so I'm partial to the kinds of neighborhoods where the sidewalks need patching and repair, where a morning walk can be kind of messy. I've been thinking about this off and on since I took that walk the other morning. I wonder about our capacity, even our willingness, to accommodate a little messiness in our lives. In particular, because we live in an open society where people are free to experiment, to be different, and to pursue a variety of satisfactions. We're never in complete agreement. We're always squabbling and compromising as best we can. All of which makes things a little unfinished, a little imperfect, a little messy. So in a metaphorical way, I've come to think of cracked and broken sidewalks as a happy consequence of the open society in which we live. We could keep things in perfect repair, but to do so, we'd have to keep people in perfect synchronization, and that wouldn't be much of an open society. In a peculiar sort of way, cracked and broken sidewalks epitomize the best part of our cities and our society, the part rooted in openness, self-determination, freedom, and tolerance, no matter how messy it gets. Cities, of course, are the essence of this, for the cities that work are those that bring together a diversity of styles and influences and open up the possibilities we seek in our lives. Yet these cities can get a little messy sometimes. Deep down, we all want this. These are our shared roots. More than ever before, we recognize that no matter how much we wish everyone would see things our way, our own ambitions are better advanced by the respect and support we show for the differing ambitions of others. This makes for a messy affair, something not always easy to keep in good repair. But the shared roots that make for these metaphorical cracked and broken sidewalks are the underpinning of what's best about the lives we make for ourselves in the cities and neighborhoods in which we live. For City Views, this is Walker Smith.
Walker Smith is president of Yankelovich. He comes to us from Georgia Public Radio in Atlanta, and his new book, Generation Ageless, will be in bookstores October 2nd. Join us online at smartcityradio.com to listen to archive shows, sign up for podcasts, and register for our weekly newsletter. Smart Cities web content and audio archive are supported by CEOs for Cities, a national network of urban leaders. National distribution is made possible by the Hyde Family Foundation's investing in programs that generate lasting change to improve the future of Memphis, Tennessee and its citizens. For more information, visit HydeFoundations.org. Eric Rudd is our co-producer and engineer. I'm Carol Coletta.